Pendardine, Balverton, Michener, Comfort, Logan, Kitchen, Doan, Fell. This was their meeting. And founders of the Farmers Club were either members of this meeting or were descendants of members of this meeting. If not completely, then almost. This year, 2006, will mark the 200th anniversary of Soulberry Friends meeting. And when Joe called to ask if I would speak on that, I was silent and hesitated. And then I thought, what a perfect opportunity. I've always wanted to look further into the history of Quakerism in the Delaware Valley and Soulberry Friends meeting. So thank you for inviting me. For material, the monthly meetings send their minutes, which are records of their meetings, to the historical libraries at Swarthmore and Haverford. I looked at the original documents for our meeting from 1806 until 1811, and microfiches from 1811 for the work, for the years I'm talking about today, tonight. I also, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting Library was very helpful. Friends were helpful, such as Pat Knight, offering material, and individuals who have oral stories that they shared with me, and I appreciate their time. Since most of the club, as I said, of the Soulberry Farmers Club were members here, the time I'm going to emphasize is from the founding of Soulberry Friends to 1871, when we believe the Farmers Club had their initial meeting, which was the Soulberry Friends School across the road here. I am going to give a background on Quakerism slightly to place us, our members here into history, into Quaker history. I'm wearing this attire to help take us back in the time when the meeting was built, when this dress would have been, for the most part, worn by the female members. The silk bonnets from my great-grandmother, whose families on both sides came from this area originally in the early 1700s, the Roberts and the Huffs. Then they moved to California and then to Indiana, where they were part of the Underground Railway and worked with Levi Coffin. The dress is based on a pattern, an authentic pattern, as is this. And I'm going to remove the hat. This is a cap, which also is authentic. And it was worn around the house, but I will speak more about the dress later. Another reason I chose to wear these garments was not for a costume, but rather to remind me and all of us to keep the stories and events in historical context, and to remember the sincerity and devotion of those who worshipped here, and to treat them tenderly. I'll first describe some of the Quaker culture that the buildings of this that the builders of this meeting house descended from, and I won't mention good works except when they might apply to architecture or historical facts. Of course, that's a missing whenever you're talking about a religion, that will be missing, but that's not our purpose tonight. As you know, George Fox was a spiritual leader and founder of Quakerism, and many of his followers as well as himself were persecuted. So when William Penn's father received a grant from the king, who owed him a debt, he gave his son, who was a convinced friend, the land. And such was the hope for the great experiment, Penn's experiment in Pennsylvania. The first Quaker colonists arrived around 1660s, not with Penn. He didn't come until the 1680s. These people were, for the most part, English, Welsh, and Irish. They worked hard, they were industrious, they were frugal, they were honest, and they did well. And some of them did very well. There were even fortunes amassed. But they adhered to their faith and to simplicity, which was one of the tenets. Although we'll see that simplicity is in time and place. And we learned from David Miller last year that he talked about a Thomas Offlet, who was a wonderful cabinet maker and did some of the finer chest on chest. He was a practicing Quaker, and he sold not only to members of other religions or more ostentatious furnishings, but also to Quakers. But perhaps with some changes, simplifying, making it just a little plainer, that would be acceptable to the wealthier Quakers at the time. George Fox spoke on being in the world, but not of the world. And friends were reminded to maintain simplicity, that material wealth was transitory, and the only thing in life was the inner light, or that of God within. In the 1750s now, we'll jump ahead, Quakerism was gaining until that time, and it was advantageous to belong because Quakers tended to support each other. And also, they ran the political system in Philadelphia, and were leaders in the community. However, after the 1750s, the political climate changed. It was a time of the Indian Wars, and it was a time leading up to the Revolution. And the Friends Peace Testimony, which has been a testimony from the very beginning, was not looked upon favorably. And they, as a matter of fact, the Thomas Affleck, whom I mentioned being the cabinet maker, was, along with 16 other friends, exiled into Winchester, Virginia, falsely accused of treason against the newly formed United States of America because he would not swear an oath. A friend's friend's honesty was enough. They were willing to affirm, but they wouldn't swear. There were two Quakers who died. There was no habeas corpus, and it was quite wrong in the way it was carried out, and two friends died during that time. Many friends withdrew from politics, and it was decided that among the friends in Philadelphia that perhaps it was better to move inward, tend the spiritual, but a spiritual inwardness. So they withdrew from politics. There was perhaps a complacency on the part of the younger generation. And they also wanted to have, the older friends wanted to find, to get back the zeal that they had had in the very beginning. And they felt perhaps the best way to do that was to concentrate on the inward. So this was a time they withdrew from politics, but they built schools for the children. And this, but with that came an emphasis on stricter discipline as they withdrew inwardly. Friends were not as numerous as they once were. They were losing members, but they kept enforcing the discipline. This brings us to the Delaware Valley out into Buckingham and Solbury. And I will speak on the model for a Quaker meeting. There is no model for a Quaker meeting. There's one piece extracted from George Fox where he says, "And as concerning the meeting place itself, whether the barn or the house, I shall leave it to you. But if the barn will do better, if you could make it a little wider, and the ground may be raised that you may go up a step or two to go into the meeting, and it will be perhaps more wholesome. You will have stones enough and poor men to dig them. I would have all the thatch pulled off all the houses. Let all the houses be slated, and the walls about it to be made substantial to stand, and laid in lime and sand. I would have a porch made to the meeting place of the on the common side of the yard, and I would have the meeting place large, for truth may increase." Then he speaks of using the local indigenous materials, so that in Egg Harbor, New Jersey, for example, you'll find meeting houses made of wood, whereas in this area, they're made of stone. They were to fit in the environment, to blend in. And just the fact that we call our meeting place a house, notice the windows, the doors, it was to be a part of the life, of the daily life. There was no design that was dictated, although early designs, very early, prior to 1705, was based on the English style. And the English style, the men and women met together, as did men and women in Philadelphia yearly meeting, and then had separate business meetings. Remember I said that there was an emphasis on discipline. When one of the disciplines was to not marry outside the faith. So the women's business meeting was in charge of marriages. The women had a lot more business to take care of now, because there were more, each time there was a wedding outside the faith, they needed to be disciplined. And I will speak how that was done just a little later. So the women's business meeting grew in importance. And that was one of the reasons that the design of the meeting house changed. Women now not only did not meet with the men together for worship, but worshiped separately and had their business separately. In our area, back in 1705 now, when the first log meeting house was built on the site of the graveyard in Buckingham, our people, but at that time, I don't believe there was any structure in this, right in this area. But the meeting enlarged such that they built a stone structure. I didn't find the year, I wasn't able to find the year, but in 1728, I believe it was, a quote-unquote copious little building, a commodious little building was built to accommodate friends. And then in 1767 and 8, the present meeting house was built. This was the model for the double meeting house as we know it today. It was the first one and from which the others were modeled. There are in the minutes friends coming from New York, from other areas to see Buckingham. They went back home and copied the Buckingham model. As I've said, it was divided equally now that the women were meeting separately and the men were meeting separately. No longer was the group together in one, and then the smaller women's business in a smaller area. So when the Buckingham meeting reached around 1,000 members, I've seen quoted, the Solbury, this was 1805, Solbury farmers requested that they separate and build their own meeting house. In 1705, William Penn granted Jonathan Pike of Cork County, Ireland, a patent deed with 624 acres known as the Pike Tract, 2 miles long, 1/2 mile wide, right back of you, Meeting House Road area. It was inherited and surveyed by Richard Pike of Cork County, Ireland, who didn't come, into 6 lots, starting numbered 5 to 10, because he also owned other land, with presumably lots 1 through 4. Lot number 10 was purchased by Thomas Paxton Jr. and passed on to Aaron Paxton. In 1805, Solbury Meeting, as it would be known, purchased 3 acres from Aaron and Letitia Paxton, members of Solbury Meeting, for $180. I'm going to read from the minutes of that meeting requesting. We, the subscribers of the committee appointed to procure land in Solbury to erect a meeting house in 1806, having attended to the business of our appointment, agree to report that Aaron Paxton and John Blackfan have offered suitable ground at the corner of said Blackfan and Robert Eastburn land on the said Aaron Paxton line at a moderate price, and the members intended to constitute that meeting, having presented a plan of a house to be about 63 feet long and 36 feet wide, to be erected merely on the model of Buckingham meeting, which we estimate with the contingent expenses will cost £1,500 in the execution, and themselves subscribed £1,346.15 to carry into effect. This plan has received our full concurrence. That the Soulbury Group has the support of Buckingham is evident from the following minutes also. Their liberality, that means the amount of money they put into this project, merits the concurrent pecuniary aid of their brethren, particularly that branch of the meeting from which they are about to separate to complete the design, and place them in as comfortable a situation as those will be left in from whom they separate. I thought that was very tender. Soulbury Friends meeting separated in 1806, of the meeting house was built in the summer and fall of 1806, and they had their first meeting for worship in December. However, this was called a preparatory meeting. It was not called a monthly meeting. A monthly meeting means that business can be conducted. But Soulbury and Plumstead meetings both conducted business with Buckingham monthly meetings. I'm going to just give you a brief definition of terms. Once I've explained a monthly meeting that has permission to conduct their business, every monthly meeting belongs to a quarterly meeting. Presently, there are 13 meetings in our quarter, for example. Wrightstown, Boston, Buckingham, etc. Then, once a year, the quarterly meetings meet in Philadelphia at Arch Street meeting for the yearly meeting. So when I refer to monthly, quarterly, and yearly, that's what I'm referring to. The meeting house is the double model based on the Buckingham model. Used the finest materials. The panels and the wainscotings are, as it says in the minutes, the finest, the cleanest white pine. And And it has aged to this beautiful color, all the wainscotings. The benches are poplar, fine poplar. These are all original and made to fit in this space. And the desk, one for the women's side, desk and chair, and the inkwell is here. One for the men's side, this is the men's side, the west, and one for the women's side. There were horse blocks, horse mounts, one in front of the west entrance and one in front of the east entrance. There was a stone split in two and put in front of each entrance. Daryl would be lower the panel. Part of the beauty of this building is everything has a purpose and it's practical. And notice how everything fits. The stairways are tucked. The windows behind the facing benches are shorter than all the other windows. When the meeting needed to be together, these came down. And in Buckingham, they even pivot. So you had a complete open, you have a complete open. But all of these panels can come down. Also, if you look here, this particular one is floored over, but the existing one there can easily be, the floorboards are removed, and it exposes a beautiful gallery. And it, there are three windows on that end, and three windows on that end. It's very light, it's very beautiful. The way to remove those is to, they have a rag or leather, and the men stand at the end, put it underneath, and lift it up, too, and lift it over. And this summer we had it off, and then we put it in to conserve heat in the winter.
It's designed two men to take these both these floors out without getting bothered.
And was it originally this was an old
construction of this
one also?
Just yeah, this was
the
both sides.
But just this part, not.
No, just.
You can't, to you, you would think that this had a galley too, and it used to, but now the sewing group meets there, so it's a, they put a more permanent floor. But this side is, in, this cannot be easily removed. It could be brought back to that state, but this one can and is easily, and the gallery is very nice. Notice how the steps are fit very nicely in the corner. The facing benches aren't necessary for worship, but this is where the overseers sat, and the overseers would be those who had, whose lives were exemplary to the rest of the Quaker community. And today, these are used for weddings and funerals, but other people also can sit there. Meeting houses today don't need to have facing benches, but they are still used. There are, if you look behind you, I believe these two to be original, the boxes behind. They're little boxes that are, they're empty inside, but they show the patina of the rest of the paneling, and it is the same white pine. I would say in the minutes they talked about night meetings, they had few night meetings, but they talked about lanterns or lamps. So I would think they were coil or that type of thing, but they could be candles. But it's some type of storage, because you see there's no other storage for. And notice the doors, how easily they lock. This is so much easier than a this, and then open the door. But this is locked. When you put this in, no one's going to open this door. We found that this has been up in the Carol of June.
Yeah, they used to have funerals here. And this was the gadget that they used to carry the casket across the street. And it's ingenious, actually, because the casket on that. And then men get a hold of this thing. A man on the other end, and you carry the casket. This is the casket.
But they have, it's the same sort of turning as, and I draw your attention to the ends of the benches. They're very handsome, very nice to touch. And that differs from meeting to meeting. That's the one thing that you'll find individual differences. The master builder of this meeting house was Elias Do I have his first name correct? Fell. And I believe it was Elias, but the wood was worked on the farm, on the Fell farm, on the hill on 263, the ancestors of the Tinsman family. And the builders were members of meetings. The stone was quarried from local stone for the cornerstones, for the foundation. There's a 2.5 foot rise to get into the building. The rest of the building, the stone building itself, is from field stone, gathered from local stone. And there's an account in our 100th anniversary celebration from 1907 where a lady talks of the Matilda Janning of Haverford reported her father, Robert Ely, held his father George's horses while unloading stone for the meeting house. John Blackfan performed the same service for his father, John Sr. So the stones were hauled in from the local field. There were three wooden carriage sheds, and the stone part where the fireplace was, what of the building where you just, we call it the first day school building, where you just had dinner, was used for mounts, for mounting, for mount horses. And then the Quaker sheds were used for the horse and carriage. In Buckingham Minutes, I found that families had their own space, and it was designed, they were given a certain amount of space they could have for their horse and buggy. And I would imagine, since these people came from Buckingham Meeting, it worked the same way here. Thaddeus Kinderdine in 1906 recalls, "I often think of our long hilly ride over the road from Lumberton to Soulbury Friends Meeting, with one horse, the swinging, one-seated gig sufficed. Then the two-seated round-top wagon, and then the family grew larger, and the older boys went on horseback and stabled them in a shed provided for that purpose." And that would be the shed across the way, the stone part. It was added on to, it has been added on to twice. In 1840, the building across the way and 25 purchase of land were purchased from John Blackfan. The house is of quarried stone, and it's federal style. And it was built about 1836, purchased in 1840. In 1843 to 1844, Edward Hicks McGill, who was the ancestor of Joe, who would become a future president of Swarthmore College, became the school's first teacher. Some of the members of that first class were Eastburn Reader, Wallace Paxson, George Blackfan, Lambert Paxson, Robert Eastburn, George Eastburn. Robert Eastburn recalls throwing snowballs at the 1806 on the side of the building of the quarried stone, is the date, 1806. the master craftsman or builder couldn't or wouldn't put their name. That would be not going along with our simplicity. But the 1806 was on the corner. Also, Edward Hicks McGill recalls receiving a knife from his father, and he was occupying his time during the men's meeting and carved his initials on a bench here, and I found them. They're right on the back of the bench behind Pat. Sure enough, E. Edward Hicks, H.N., you'll find right back on that bench, just almost behind Pat. The stone schoolhouse was given to the township for a public school after public education was well established, and it was continued until about 1898 and 1899, when it was left empty until 1923, when the Young Friends refurbished it, and now it's a caretaker's house. In 1808, 15 perches were purchased from Robert Eastburn for a burial ground. And it's interesting, around this time, after Solbury has established, has their own meeting house, I read in the Buckingham Minutes, these are Buckingham Minutes now, all fixtures to graves with inscriptions thereon in order to distinguish one grave from another is contrary to the direction of the discipline. And as a great variety of such have been placed in our graveyard at Buckingham, some of them by members of Solbury, we believe it would be proper for the monthly meetings to attend to the removal of them. But as this departure may have been generally from a want of a perfect knowledge of the discipline, great tenderness toward the survivors ought to be exercised. We therefore suggest the propriety of using persuasive measures to be used to indulge such surviving relatives to remove or consent to the removal of these monuments. You probably, or some of you at least, have heard of the term, Roe. Help me out. Sally, you're the one who told me in Pat, where the indigent people, Strangers Row is what there's nothing in the records where it's called that, but it probably has become a term used because indigents, there was permission given to bury indigents or those who wouldn't have enough means to be buried, and they're buried along Sudan Road to the left. As you go in the first entrance, which is the old walled part, they're buried along that road. And the main part of the cemetery had been divided and given to families so that families, any of their people who were working for them or descendants of those families could be buried in the plot of the members. Simplicity in dress and this became more important as I told you about the inward seeking. The dress became, the plainness of the dress became more important than it had been earlier in the 1700s. In fact, George Fox's wife, who was a fellow and whose father was a judge, thought it was to be careful that the dress didn't take on too much meaning. And in fact, that it did for a while become that, that there was a lot of emphasis given to the plainness of the dress. However, there were five pieces. There was a shawl, which I don't have, the dress, which buttoned down the front, or not buttoned, but in most cases, other types of closure, although buttons could be used for a closure, just a simple sleeve and gather, a kerchief or neckerchief, as I've seen both terms used, the cap, which would be worn every day or under the bonnet, and then a bonnet, and usually all of them made out of the finest fabrics and the very, very high quality workmanship. And there is a beauty in simplicity, but also it lasts longer and can be repaired better. The peace testimony, and there were two men from this meeting who were imprisoned for non-payment of their fines for not bearing arms. And John, in 1820, John Comfort paid a draft of $96 and had property seized by Isaac Griffith, the U.S. Marshal at the time, and the property was worth $136. George Ely also paid $96 and had property seized worth $188. But during the Civil War, there's a very tender minute written about the difficulty of the men deciding how they could maintain the peace testimony, many of them having difficulty. And some of them did go to war. And on one occasion, it tells of the father, Hugh Eastburn recalls the father's getting word during meeting that there's been a battle at Gettysburg, and one of the sons is fighting at Gettysburg, and immediately three men volunteer to go and help with the medical side, and they bring home the dead son. As I've mentioned, simplicity was a tenet, but in general, Quakerism called on the option to choose change and follow one's inner conscience and to set bounds for oneself, so that it's difficult to find a true Quaker aesthetic. There is a simplicity that's understood, but it's not defined. There's an admonishment for extravagance in weddings and funerals. And this is the ninth month, the ninth, 11th month, 1821. And the numbers were used to avoid using names of gods, so that you don't use Monday, Tuesday, or July, August, September. So it's ninth month, or tenth, ninth month, and then the year. It says, a concern spread with weight in that meeting, and this is a quarterly meeting, to the unnecessary parade of extravagance of marriages and other occasions, which they do to commemorate, to communicate to this meeting for its claiming solid attention of the meeting, to claim solid attention of the meeting in this matter. Moses Paxson, John Comfort, Aaron Eastburn, George Ely, Oliver Hampton are appointed to have the subject under their care and to give such advice to our members on this important concern as in the wisdom of the truth they may find. Equality is another tenet, and as I said, in 1681, women had their separate business meetings and enjoyed more quality than most women of the time. They were ministers and elders of meetings. In 1741, Philadelphia Yearly Meeting and had been urging quarterly meetings to choose women as elders. And in this Bucks County, it was in 1741 when we had our first woman overseer, or elder, excuse me, which meant she would sit here with the men. And women could inherit property and keep it in their name and not have to have it in their husband's name, even though he managed it. Men usually did deal with the financial issues, and that's why their meeting room was larger. They had more business. That was prior to 1767. The plain language. In England, George Fox used it, and as did the Friends of that time, to as an indication of the equality of everyone.